I'm News.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David Furst. The United Nations Climate Change Conference begins in Copenhagen on Monday. The UN is hoping to draft an agreement to replace the Kyoto Protocol. But among power players like Barack Obama, there will be a new group on the scene, youth. For the first time, young people from around the world who attend these talks will be officially recognized as a constituency. This means they'll be able to hold press conferences, lobby government delegates, and even make speeches. Ginger Mord met with youth delegates from the D.C. area to find out how they expect to make a difference in Copenhagen.
On Monday, he's meeting with the Chinese ambassador. Wednesday, it's U.S. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu. But Ben Wessel is not your typical diplomat.
My name is Ben Wessel. I'm a 20-year-old college student. I'm a Washington, D.C. native.
Wessel is headed to the UN Climate Change Conference with a group of 25 other 19 to 26-year-olds from across the country. They were selected by the D.C.-based nonprofit Sustain Us to coordinate activities of all the American youth at the conference. Their goal? To get government parties to agree to lower greenhouse gas emissions and to decrease dependency on fossil fuels.
There are going to be 500 United States youth coming to these negotiations, and they're going to be on top of literally thousands of youth from around the world who are really growing in the last couple of years into their own political movement. So it's not just, you know, a couple of kids, it's thousands of them.
That's Kyle Gracie. He's the chair of the U.S. Youth Delegates. He's a 26-year-old grad student at the University of Chicago, but lately he's been sleeping on friends' couches in D.C. The closer he is to the Hill, the easier his work. When U.S. delegates meet with their peers from other countries at the conference, Gracie believes they're going to be a force to be reckoned with, just like they were last year when he attended the conference in Poland.
So the picture here is it's almost the end of the negotiations. Al Gore is up on the plenary stage speaking. Young people have packed the back of the negotiating hall. And again, this is, you know, hundreds of youth. And he finishes speaking, and we all sort of file out of the back of the negotiations very quietly, very peacefully. And then assemble in mass right outside of the negotiating hall. We unfurl these big banners, survival is not negotiable. And all the reporters are filing out and coming and paying attention to what we're saying. That was sort of the defining movement of our movement is ready to go.
This year, for the first time ever, the UN is officially recognizing the youth as a civil society constituency. This means that instead of holding meetings in hallways, like they did last year, the UN will reserve a meeting room for them. They'll have an office right outside of the negotiating hall, and they won't have to beg the secretariat for time to speak in plenary sessions. The Youth Civil Society constituency will now have 2 speaking slots per session, guaranteed. Ben Wessel.
I feel confident now that since youth have this, you know, very official position where we'll have our own placard and we'll be able to press the button on the microphone and say, you know, I object, that the real views of the global population will be articulated.
Organizing over 1,500 young people from around the world, that's kind of tricky. Gracie and Wessel started multinational conference calls in August to hash out a plan. The first thing that came out of these calls were 2 to 3 page position papers on topics like forests, finance, and technology transfer. The UN Secretariat has distributed these papers to all government parties. At the conference, youth assigned to public relations duty will gather information from negotiating sessions and then create messages for the media and the outside world. This is the soundtrack to a YouTube video that shows 18-year-old Ebony Payne brushing her teeth above a caption that reads, "The average American uses 100 gallons of water daily." She created the video as a senior at DC School Without Walls, and now she'll be on the action team in Copenhagen.
So an action could be something that's a photo op. So I can give you an example. Like Greenpeace had an action where somebody dressed up as a homeless bear, and he had a sign saying, "No coins, I need real change." Something that Americans will look at in the newspaper is like, oh, I get that.
Position papers, plenary sessions, dressing up as a bear. Gracie thinks it's just what the conference needs.
You know, they can be pretty long, boring, difficult days, but young people keep it fresh and they keep it real. I mean, we have done raps about policy in plenary sessions in front of all of the delegates. We have, you know, we printed up all of these t-shirts that said, "How old will you be in 2050? And we gave them out to all of the delegations.
Still, Wessel gets his thrills from the more wonkish aspects of the conference.
You definitely haven't lived until you've curled up on the floor of a negotiation room because you were blogging until 3 a.m. and you don't have time to go back to your hostel before your 6 a.m. meetings.
So Barack Obama, Gordon Brown, Nicolas Sarkozy, when you're stumbling around the negotiating room in the middle of the night, please watch where you're walking. You may be stepping on one of our future leaders. For Metro Connection, I'm Ginger Morad.
And from college-age students jet-setting overseas, we focus now on charter schools in the district. The D.C. Public Charter School Board is in the process of creating a separate nonprofit corporation. The intent is to attract more grant dollars, which can be spent on research. Tom Nida heads the current board and in a few months will complete his second and final term. Kavitha Cardoza speaks with Nida about his role in the new nonprofit and what he hopes to accomplish.
There are some of the foundations and other funders that by their own bylaws cannot make grants to independent government agencies, that they can only make grants to 501c3 nonprofit corporations. So we thought it was a logical step to take. And in doing so, we could separate the research and development function. And in doing so, look at ways we could generate extra funding, take some of the budgetary pressure off of the current budget we have, and have it separated from the day-to-day operations of the Charter Board.
And so what would some of the examples of research and development projects be?
Well, for the charter schools themselves, we are looking at doing research on what are emerging best practices, not only with academic issues, but also looking at things such as financial management and school governance. These are factors that often lead to schools stumbling and sometimes being closed before they ever get to academic issues. We have our fiscal responsibility handbook. We this year are rolling out our whole new performance management framework, and that is intended hopefully to better be able to gauge charter school performance broadly, including academics and governance and finance. And so we think if we could help spur some of the research into those arenas and then publish that research, that we could provide, you know, another tool for charter schools to use.
Right now, how is research and development funded?
We've had some R&D funded by grants from some of the larger foundations, such as Gates, Dell, and the Walton family, and they have allowed us to help create such things as the new performance management framework. So these are just potentially very broad-based, widely applicable tools, and we also may think about some of these tools we've created, which are uniquely ours, with the idea of possibly copywriting those tools and then providing a licensing revenue that maybe can help us reduce our D.C. government appropriation.
Tom Nida, head of the D.C. Public Charter School Board, speaking with Kavitha Cardoza. Later in the show, let there be model trains. We succumb to holiday magic at the U.S. Botanic Garden. But before that, the debate over health care reform has certainly been a healthy one. Commentator Fred Fisk says when it comes to keeping insurance costs low, nothing beats keeping a population healthy in the first place.
The protracted battle over health care in the Congress, in the media, and elsewhere is one of the most significant in our history. It's important to all of us, and especially important to the 45 million of our fellow Americans who are uninsured. The program being debated in Congress is expensive. The Congressional Budget Office estimates its cost at $849 billion over the next decade, about as much as the war in Afghanistan. If it were not that some 160 million Americans are provided health care by their employers, we could not even contemplate the program before the Congress. A very serious problem arises, however, when we consider the fact that the cost to employers of delivering health care has risen 31% in the last 5 years and now represents the fastest growing single corporate expense. Some corporations found that health care costs were taking a big bite out of their earnings, and they began to pass along extra costs to employees, who were understandably not happy to see their paychecks shrink. Some corporations, and the city of Boston, began to look for ways to reduce health care costs and to profit by keeping workers on the job. They found that 75% of the country's health care bill goes to treating four chronic diseases: obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and cancer. They discovered that most cases of these diseases are preventable because they're caused by behavior, like poor diets, inadequate exercise, and smoking. Healthcare costs related to obesity alone account for 9% of spending. In another decade, that cost could go up to 20%. Dr. Kenneth Thorpe of Emory University estimates that if obesity fell to 1987 levels, it would free up enough money to cover the nation's uninsured population. Dr. Dean Ornish of the University of California has published research showing that diet and lifestyle changes can turn on genes that prevent disease and lower the incidence of heart disease as well as prostate and breast cancer. Many corporations are now successfully prodding employees to become healthier, thus trimming health care costs and increasing earnings. IBM invested $80 million in 2005 and 2007 in employee wellness programs. They found that they saved $190 million in health care costs. $79 million was from fewer medical claims, the rest from reduced absenteeism and increased productivity. Safeway checks employees' weight, blood pressure, and cholesterol levels, and whether people smoke. For every test that they pass, workers get reductions in payroll contributions to health care. For most, this adds up to about $800 a year. In addition, many companies are providing more healthful foods in their cafeterias, exercise facilities, and are conducting health and diet awareness programs. It serves the interests of the companies, the employees, and the nation. This is Fred Fisk.
At 18 minutes past the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Sanju K. Bansal Foundation, dedicated to helping people help themselves through improved access to information. From Oshkosh Corporation, a global business delivering vehicles and equipment for the world's defense, emergency, and commercial applications for more than 90 years. Oshkosh, beyond confidence.
There's still time to improve your tax situation by April. Your gift of stock or securities to WAMU 88.5 helps maintain your favorite news station. And by giving now, you'll be eligible for a 2009 tax deduction and help WAMU 88.5 in the coming year. For more information on giving stock or securities, check with your financial advisor or call 202-885-1253. And thank you.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David First. For 15 years, Hungry for Music has been working to provide musical instruments for kids whose parents can't afford to pay for them. The D.C. nonprofit marks the occasion this month with a Hanukkah concert and a new collection of Elvis music. We're joined by Hungry for Music founder Jeff Campbell, who can help explain how he got involved with something called the Night of 100 Elvises. Jeff, welcome back.
Hey, David. Thanks a lot.
I guess after that introduction, we should start talking about Elvis. Tell us about this Night of 100 Elvises show. It's happening tonight and tomorrow night, Saturday night, up in Baltimore.
That's right. I got involved with Elvis probably, this is actually the 16th year they've done it. It benefits the Johns Hopkins Children's Hospital. And like I said, we've been involved for probably 12 of those 16 years. They've allowed us to have a table to promote Hungry for Music and to allow us to have raffles to raise money for our purpose.
And at the show tonight, you're going to be releasing a brand new CD of Elvis music.
That's right. It's Night of 100 Elvises Live. And we had released a CD before of studio cuts. And after we had done that, a lot of people requested if we could release something with some of the live performances that they've had at the show over the years. And that's what we're doing. There's 20 cuts. It's culled from the last 5 years.
Okay, can we hear a cut from the new CD?
Yeah, that would be great. It's a Robert Lighthouse cut called Mystery Train.
Robert Lighthouse taking on the classic Mystery Train. All right, let's take a listen.
Train to ride, 60 coaches low. Train to ride.
Robert Lighthouse taking on Mystery Train. This is from the new CD, Night of 100 Elvises Live. This is coming out officially tonight. You'll be able to buy this at the show up in Baltimore. Tell us where the show's happening.
It's at the Lithuanian Hall in Baltimore. It's been there for 16 years. It's a really cool place, and it's literally a night of 100 Elvises. They have three different stages, Elvis impersonators and bands doing Elvis songs. It's really a lot of fun.
For those coming with a calculator, will there actually be 100 Elvises?
There's probably 101 Elvises, actually.
You're covering your bases in case one of the Elvises is sick. You've got a spare.
That's right.
Will the CD also be available on your website, hungryformusic.com?
It sure is. It's available at the show and at our website. And at this point, that's the only place it's available.
Well, give us a sense for what Hungry for Music is all about. You launched this to provide musical instruments for children back in 1994?
We provide music instruments to underprivileged children with a hunger to play. The instruments go to individual kids in need in underprivileged schools, community programs, orphanages, and other institutions. And I guess our niche is providing instruments to help parents who can't afford the monthly rental or to purchase an instrument for their child. From my experiences, I believe that music has a very amazing healing power. Putting an instrument into a kid's hands has the potential to change his life. And our goal is just to get as many instruments out there as we can. So far, over the 15 years, we've donated over 3,000 instruments, and I'd like to one day say I've donated a million. Who knows? But it's a lofty goal, but I think we can do it. It's been a slow process, and it grows a little bit every year.
Well, let's talk about your future. A primary way that you raise money has been through the sales of special CDs. These are all various artist collections. You've done baseball-themed albums, Christmas collections, Hanukkah. But as we all know, CD sales are way down, and the format seems to be on the way out. Is your funding mechanism changing as the music industry changes?
Oh, yes. I think we're going to have to. Well, one thing that we can do, and one thing that we haven't done in the past, is get permission to sell the songs as downloads. And that's one thing that we're going to do. And you'll see on our site that we'll begin having song downloads and sell them that way. But we've pretty much supported ourselves through, like you said, the CDs and raffles and benefit concerts. And that's pretty much it. But I think we're going to have to have more partnerships with other like-minded organizations and perhaps look into more sponsorships and money through foundations and corporate sponsorships.
All right. But it hasn't all gone to new downloads yet. We still have some new CDs on the way. There's this Elvis CD out right now. And in the past, you've released a couple of Hanukkah music collections, and there's a big Hanukkah concert coming up next week?
That's right. It's an annual show that we started in 2004 after we released the first Hanukkah CD. In 2006, we released the second one.
Tell us about the show. Who's going to be there, and where is it happening?
It's happening at the Silver Spring Montgomery College Performing Arts Center. It's December 13th. It starts at 7 p.m. And Alexandria Klestet, Lox and Vodka, Mark Lickman, Klezcentricity, Mark Novak, also known as MC Maccabee, and Alan Oreski is going to be playing.
The Silver Spring Montgomery College Performing Arts Center, this is on Georgia Avenue?
That's right. It just opened, I believe, in September. They had a grand opening concert with Aretha Franklin.
Well, let's hear some music from one of the Hanukkah CDs. What would you like to play?
Well, it's the lead song from Hanukkah Feast 2. It's Deanna Bogart doing a wonderful piano rendition of Dreidel, Dreidel.
Okay, let's hear a little bit of this one. This is Deanna Bogart. Deanna Bogart, kind of giving Dreidel, Dreidel the Charlie Brown Christmas treatment there.
Yeah, it definitely has a Vince Guaraldi feel to it. It's one of my favorite songs from the CD for sure.
That's irresistible. What a great sound, Deanna Bogart. And you can find that on a collection called A Hanukkah Feast, Volume 2. And all of your CDs are available on your website, hungryformusic.org. The Hanukkah Music Show, is happening at the Silver Spring Montgomery College Performing Arts Center on Sunday, December 13th?
That's right.
And the Elvis Show, the Night of 100 Elvises, that is happening tonight and tomorrow night, Saturday night. This is up in Baltimore. Can you give us the name of the theater one more time?
The Lithuanian Hall in Baltimore.
The Lithuanian Hall. For information about both of these shows and the CDs, you can visit our website. We'll have all of the links there. Just go to metroconnection.org. Jeff Campbell, good to see you again.
Good to see you, David. Thanks for having me on.
Jeff Campbell is the founder of Hungry for Music.
I'll have a blue Hanukkah without you. I'll be so blue thinking about you.
Okay, pull out the kitty litter and the sheet metal. It's time for a little Shakespearean radio drama. Lean and Hungry Theater, a company based in D.C., mixes old-school sound effects with Shakespeare's classics and performs in front of a live audience. The results are available as CDs or podcasts. And tonight and tomorrow, Lean and Hungry stages The Winter's Tale. It may be a made-for-radio show, but it will take place in the cavernous hall of the St. Stephen and the Incarnation Church in D.C.'s Columbia Heights neighborhood. Stephanie Kay speaks with the show's director, Ryan Winham, and company members Alex Zavistovich and Jessica Hansen.
There is a storm sequence in the play, and so getting the sound of surf is kind of interesting. That there's just sort of a box filled with cat litter, frankly, but if you
queen.
Listen, queen cat litter. Yeah. Yeah. You sort of close your eyes and you kind of get that feeling, and then this is really just a sheet of metal that any Home Depot would have. There's just sort of minor technique associated with this, but. Going at once.
And then the actors are making those.
If I can do one more thing, the one thing that's kind of cool is this thing. This is just an L for a downspout for a home. And what's interesting is the effect that you get when you start talking through it. So I play Antigonus, who has the beauty of having like the best stage direction. Exit, pursued by bear. So we didn't want to just like record, you know, get a recording of a bear and just have him snarling out there. We have
we can be more creative than that.
We have a terrific actor, Steve Bell, who's going to be the sound of the bear. But if you just do the normal bear growling sound, like a that kind of thing, with the benefit of this.
I would imagine that is exactly what it would sound like as a bear is chasing.
Right, and yeah, and you right exactly. So I think that's. I mean, the only other thing I suppose that we could talk about is the idea of how you convey someone's pocket being picked, because Autolycus is a pickpocket.
Okay. You know, how do you do that then?
Well, what we decided what we could convey was we have a
slide whistle answers many problems in
slide whistle and an actual sock full of pennies. So, you know, I have something to protect myself when I'm walking home at night also. But but we figure, you know, a combination of the two, sort of a
and there goes your money.
That's right.
Yeah. Now why do this as a radio show? Why did you guys get this idea?
Jess and I were talking about this once, and you know, we knew we wanted to do something together, and so Shakespeare was easy, an easy decision to make, just because everybody, all actors love working their chops on Shakespeare, and it's royalty-free. But there's no shortage of Shakespeare companies here, so how do we differentiate ourselves from what's going on in the rest of the market? I just happen to be a huge fan of Prairie Home Companion. I listen, and then just sort of that feeling of a soundscape sure. that gets built during his shows is just really a fascinating concept to, like, can we do that? And it gives what we do a little bit more permanence, because if we can capture it on CD and then use that as a way to educate and inform folks who might otherwise not have an opportunity, we've actually done a great service. So it kind of built in steps that way. Ryan Winham, who's our director, had this idea of doing this piece in contemporary time, as though the Sicilia Empire is West Virginia and D.C. represents Bohemia. So there's a lot of that mountain music kind of theme in some of the original songs.
Why The Winter's Tale?
Well, all of our choices for this season and next season align with the church calendar. So this is the first of a series of four. The Winter's Tale aligns with Advent and Christmas. Next we'll do Merchant of Venice, which aligns with Pentecost. Midsummer will align with ordinary time in the summer. And Measure for Measure will align with Lent and Easter.
Why set it in, did you say West Virginia plays a role, D.C. area?
Well, I was looking for a way to bring what Shakespeare was trying to do to a modern age. So when we were talking about, you know, what Sicilia was, what Bohemia was, we were looking for something that would be easily identifiable to someone who was listening as sort of an urbanite society. And I was like, well, D.C. And then we were like, well, what would represent, you know, because Bohemia is sort of, it's a rural place, but it has all these great traditions and this great music and everything like that. And I thought, well, what place is near D.C. that has a great rural tradition?
Yeah.
And West Virginia popped to mind. And it also helped that we have a couple of West Virginians in the cast.
It's actually useful for us because the theater's charter is to bring the Shakespearean classics and classics in general to less well-served audiences and communities. And Columbia Heights, having a large population where English might not be the first language, putting these classic texts in a context where they're hearing them with the accents that they may be more accustomed to hearing English spoken in makes it a little bit more relevant to them and a little bit easier to understand. And what's terrific is to hear that the actors can sort of dial down the training, you know, and just make the lines completely understandable and yet relevant for the younger or less well-versed audience.
Ryan and Alex actually worked on this a lot. There are a lot of sound effects done both, you know, glasses being clinked together to create the atmosphere of a party, and also actors actually vocally making sound effects, birds tweeting, you know, wind noise.
I see Prairie Home Companion is totally
exactly.
popping up here.
Exactly. It's Shakespeare a la Garrison, we say all the time. Absolutely. So to create sort of an audio landscape, we've tried to think about the play in terms of how do we create in the audience's ear what, you know, where this scene is taking place or how this is done. Also, though, the cool thing about making all these live sound effects, the thunder sheet and that sort of thing, the live audience that's here watching the performances, they get sort of this sneak peek behind the scenes, kind of like Universal Studios. Oh, that's how they do that. So after our last performance, all we heard was, it was so cool to see you guys doing those things. I didn't know whether I should close my eyes and listen to the play or watch how you were doing the stuff. So the live audience gets a little special treat, too.
When daffodils begin to peer with hay the doxy o'er the dale.
Ryan Winham, Alex Zavistovich, and Jessica Hansen speaking with Stephanie Kay. For more information on Lean and Hungry Theater, you can visit our website, metroconnection.org.
Oh, the sweet birds, oh, how they sing, doth set my puggin' tooth on edge.
Coming up, Christmas lights, models of D.C. landmarks built out of plant material, and my three-year-old son's dream come true, model trains everywhere you look. When we come back, we hit the Botanic Garden. At 37 minutes past the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Particles are moving again at CERN's Large Hadron Collider. I'm Joe Palca. Join me on Science Friday for an update on the world's largest atom smasher, plus freeing Spirit, the stuck Mars rover, and a look at life under the surface of the Earth. I'll check in with the chief scientist of the Deep Carbon Observatory. That's on Science Friday from NPR News.
Coming up in 22 minutes on WAMU 88.5.
I'm Emma Lyons, assignment editor for WAMU News. Slippery, snow-covered roads and beltway closures are on the horizon. We'll bring you the details on both during All Things Considered on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Art League, presenting Art Fest featuring art exhibits, demonstrations, ceramic jewelry, wearable art shows, and live music. December 4th through 6th at the Madison Annex in Old Town. More information at theartleague.org.
We're always hearing about architecture firms winning green building awards. Well, if you want to see some really green buildings, come down to the U.S. Botanic Garden on the Mall this month. The annual Holiday Magic Display includes painstakingly crafted models of National Mall buildings constructed entirely of plant material. We're here at the Botanic Garden with the garden trains running in the background, along with Executive Director Holly Shimizu. Hello.
Hello. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm sure you can't vouch for the energy efficiency of these buildings, these green buildings, but can you guarantee that they are made out of 100% plant material?
I can guarantee that they are made from plant material that Paul Bussey gets a lot from his woods in Kentucky. He goes out and gets grapevine, he gets acorns, he gets pine cones. These are the things that these buildings are made out of. And in fact, we show people how to make these so they understand the construction. Gourds are another thing he uses a lot of.
I see a gourd, half of a gourd was used as the roof of the Jefferson Memorial?
Yeah, that's my absolute favorite. It's a beautiful shape. It's a perfect way to make that dome. And so it really is an inspiration when you come here, and that's why, you know, people have to come see it.
You mentioned the artist. Can you tell us a little bit more about him? He's based in Kentucky?
Yes, Paul Bussey has a company called Applied Imagination based in Kentucky, and he's trained as a landscape architect. And he did that, but at the same time had an interest in trains, these garden railway trains. And so he started just in a small scale and for friends and for his community setting up exhibits. Well, people went crazy for his work, and he's grown and grown. And about 9 years ago, we decided that it was time for us to really do it right. And so we contacted Paul Bussey. He loves working here because it's like a gift to the nation's capital. People do come from all over, but we are now a regional hotspot at the holidays.
Now, if you want to see images to see what we're talking about, you can go to the website. Just go to metroconnection.org. This room looks like what if Santa had a can of Christmas and just sprayed it all over a room? It must get crazy here.
It does get crazy, and I always tell people, try to come when it's less busy, not at the typical predictable times when you're dying to get out of the house because you've got a house full of family, you know, around 2 o'clock on a Saturday or a Sunday. Try to come early or late or in an off time, but just come. I mean, you won't regret it. It's worth it.
Let's tiptoe into the other room, as this room is getting fairly full. We're here on a weekday, and this is a busy space already.
It is, so you can imagine weekends and the holiday days.
We're now in the room where most of the buildings are located. By buildings, I mean the recreations, the models of many of the buildings on the National Mall.
That's right. We started this by asking Paul if he would design and create some of the national monumental buildings on the Mall, and each year we buy a new building. This year, we bought the National Museum of the American Indian, and he was thrilled to create this gorgeous curved building. He used a lot of fungi.
And this is a building that has some real natural shapes to begin with.
Right, it does, and he's used shells, and I mean, he's done quite a job on it. And then we also asked him, my favorite thing is that he added the garden to the White House, and he also added the kids' swing set, so it's now the Obama White House, and we love that, and we love every detail of his buildings, which he keeps them refreshed so that if they get worn and tired, he refreshes them with new acorns and new grapevine and new details of all their ornamentation. But the U.S. Capitol has got to be an absolute favorite. I mean, it's a masterpiece.
And it's big. I mean, this stops people in their tracks when they come in.
It really does. And notice that most of these buildings are lit. So they've got little LED lights inside. For example, we have the U.S. Botanic Garden Conservatory, which has the lighted Christmas tree. Paul Bussey doesn't miss the details.
These gorgeous works of art filling the space here, I look around at all of them. Then I notice the mist coming down and them all getting wet, water pouring onto them. Is this okay?
Well, it is, because Paul actually makes some of these for even outside. So he knows that they have to be prepared for the harshest of conditions. He does put a resin on them, and this resin is the protector.
We mentioned the buildings, we mentioned, of course, the trains, but we did not mention the poinsettia exhibit.
Well, that poinsettia exhibit is fantastic because it shows how plants evolve over time, something that is economically so important and traditionally so important to us. And we explain how the plant came from a wild tree in Mexico. It was then bred for an indoor plant, and now the improvements that have been made are absolutely remarkable.
Okay, a very popular exhibit here at the U.S. Botanic Garden. Holly, again, can you tell us when the best time to come would be?
Well, I would always recommend people try to come during our evening hours. We have music, and the lighting and the magic of the evening in a conservatory is absolutely the ultimate. So I really recommend that. And go to the website to check out our evenings with music, free of charge, stroll the whole conservatory. I recommend that. And also the mornings, if you want to avoid huge crowds, and or just think about the times of day which aren't predictable, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a holiday.
How tough is this to set up, and how tough is it to take down?
It takes a year to plan this of intense work and a lot of coordination. So it's a huge effort. And taking down is a lot less complicated. And we store things. We are careful. We recycle everything.
See, when I put the Christmas tree down for the year, the putting things back in the box to me is sometimes the worst part.
Well, I will say we organize it well and we recycle well. So we don't throw anything away.
Holly Shimizu, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for being here. Bring your son back.
Okay, will do. Holly Shimizu is the executive director of the U.S. Botanic Garden. Again, for more information, go to our website. We'll have the links to those evening events. Just go to metroconnection.org.
And from the Botanic Garden to the backyard.
Yes, here we are, the first week of December. It's really the perfect time to talk about gardening. Kathy Jentz is the editor and publisher of Washington Gardener magazine, and today she's going to help us prepare for winter. Kathy, welcome back.
Great to be here again.
Winter is almost upon us.
Almost, just a few weeks away.
Is there really a lot that we have to do to prepare for winter? When I asked you about this topic, I said, well, I was wondering maybe you'd say a couple of things, tidy up this and that. You sent back a 6-page long email to me that made me very, very afraid.
Well, there's a lot of things you can do now to get prepared for next year. And that's kind of why I sent you such an ambitious list, in that next spring you'll be so busy with other chores that you might want to get a jump on things. And a lot of the things on the list are things you can do any time of year, but winter is an ideal time.
So you can really help us get a head start on next spring. And luckily, this did come with a short version here, the top 10 list of things to do to prepare for winter and get ready for next spring. Let's go right through the list here. What's number one?
Number one is tool cleaning and storage, something that a lot of us neglect to do. But if we've made a huge investment in our tools, or we have a couple favorites that we don't want to see rust away, stuck in the garden soil, and then come upon next March and pull out, and all you have is a handle in your hand, that you'll want to go ahead and get those cleaned up, get, you know, buy a rasp if you have one, an RASP rasp or sharpener. You could also use a sharpening stone and give those blades a nice sharpening. If you do your shovels, it'll be a lot easier in our area soils and clay to dig.
I never nice clean these things. I always think about, well, these things are digging in dirt. Why do they need to be cleaned?
Well, they will rust, a lot of them. And the handles, you might want to check for tightening, because a lot of them have screws that come loose. That's what happens to me a lot when you're using a hoe or a rake. All of a sudden, the head's in the ground, the handle's in your hand.
And the
two have separated on you. So you might want to check into those. You can always, you know, use the old duct tape trick to get it to last another season, but trying to tighten the screws or keep track of them is a good idea.
Okay, so tool maintenance and sharpening. What's next?
Next is setting up your bird feeders. That's if you like to have our feathered friends in your garden. This is a great time to get them acclimated and used to coming.
A time when the food starts to get scarce.
Exactly. Or at my house, the acorns are just starting to run out, and the blue jays and crows and cardinals who've been snacking on them are starting to look for other things to eat on. You can do it year-round if you'd like to have them still there. I like to keep them there year-round just because they do not just eat at your feeder, but they're going to go into your garden and eat pests and mosquitoes and that sort of thing.
Okay, so take care of the birds. Mm-hmm. What's next?
Rake leaves and build up your compost pile.
Oh,
so a two for
leaves.
One.
Come on. Can't I be done with that now?
You can, and if you want to just rake them and get them out of your life, you can. You can rake them out of your beds, mow them over, shred them up with a weed whacker or something, and then push them back into the beds so they can insulate your plants. Or you can gather them all into a compost pile and start that now, so you'll have some fresh compost for free and I have to pay for it next spring.
So you don't want to leave the beds naked of leaves.
You don't. It's nice at least to put the leaf shred compost, or if you have a mulch that you spread on your own, you can bring that in.
Okay, we've only gone through three. Let's get going here, Kathy.
So the next is related mulch around your roses, strawberries, and tender perennials. Those are the ones that really need the extra blanket in the wintertime, especially the roses. You'll notice where there's a node that they're grafted onto, and you want to cover that node in the wintertime because they're grafted onto a hardier stock, and if the less hardy graft on the top dies back, then you might just have the hardy stock come back from the bottom, and that's not a good thing.
I should mention that some of the chores you're giving us right now, you have a video of that we can link to on the website. Just go to metroconnection.org. If, for example, you don't get enough work on your own, you want to watch somebody else working, take a peek. What's next?
That's always fun to do. Clean up and till your veggie beds. So after the first frost, you'll notice that your vegetable plants have died back and don't look as good. And if you're not looking to plant any fall edibles, then you could just clear that whole thing out, cover it with straw or pine needles, or again, with a layer of shredded leaves.
So wipe out this bed, get it ready for next year. Do you dig everything out of it and then put down a cover?
I usually usually just yank the stuff out, and if the roots rot in there and go back into the soil, you're just adding more nutrients, so that's fine. What you want to do is stem any weed growth, and weeds are going to grow all winter long. So you want that layer of either straw, pine needles. You could do a cover crop, but at this point it's probably a little late for doing a cover crop.
So come spring, this bed will be ready.
Yes, and you just till in what ground cover or covering that you put on there, and you're ready to go.
Okay, come on, get me going here. Number six.
Plant your flowering bulbs. You still have time. So a lot of people aim for by Thanksgiving to get their spring flowering bulbs in the ground, but really in the DC area, you have at least till through the end of December.
Pretty soon you'll be able to go all year.
Yeah, because the ground is really still workable. We don't have any hard freezes usually until mid-January.
So really, now is an okay time to plant the flowering bulbs that will come into bloom in the springtime?
Now is the perfect time, especially for the tulips, because they didn't like to be in any earlier than now because we've had so much rain and it's such a wet, soaking soil. They don't like to sit in that too much.
Okay, so go tulip crazy.
Yeah.
Right now is a perfect time. What's next?
At the same time you're putting those spring flowering bulbs in, you can be lifting out your tender bulbs. Those are your caladiums and elephant ears and that sort. Your gladiolas, you can dig those all out, put them in the sun to dry for the afternoon, and then store them inside for the winter.
Maybe. Elephant ears, you're losing me here. What are all these plants you're talking about here?
Those are your tropical summer huge leaved looking things, your cannas, your gladiolas, and those are not really hardy in our zone. If you've dug them deep enough, they might winter over, and if we have a mild winter, you might skate by with those. But I recommend if you have some real favorites and you've gotten them to a really nice big size that you dig them up and store them in your cellar or your garage for the winter.
Okay, bring them inside in a big pot and retransfer them in the springtime.
Exactly.
Okay, what's next?
Bring in your house plants if you haven't already. I hope you have. But I see a few people with them still out on their porches, and they might last through the week. I see David raising his hand.
Yes. It's been so mild. I keep leaving it out there.
It has been mild, but it does look like we are going to hit below freezing for downtown D.C., so take it in if you can.
Put it off no longer. Yeah. Bring in the houseplants. Two more, Kathy.
Okay.
Two more.
Okay. Divide your overcrowded perennials, and this is also the best time to move those shrubs. So if you've got a shrub that's in the absolute worst place, this is the time to move it. Give it a chance to get settled in before the winter winds start.
What do you mean by absolute worst place in terms of the way it looks or the health of the shrub?
Probably for the health, or if it's outgrown its space and it's hitting people in a pathway, say, and it's constantly getting broken, then you might want to move it.
Really? This is the best time to do that?
This is the best time. You're going to let it settle in for about 6 weeks, and then winter will start, so it can just sleep and then be ready in the springtime to just shoot off and grow.
And the soil's not too hard?
Not at all. Actually, with the recent rains, it's really easy to dig, and I recommend not fertilizing it. You know, there's always a tendency when you plant something new to add a handful of fertilizer to the hole or throw it on top, but wait until spring to fertilize it. Let it settle in. It's going to have a big enough shock as it is.
Okay, so it's time to get our fingers cold in the dirt then, moving those shrubs. And the final one on the list here
is now you can work in some of the compost and fertilizer around your evergreens and your trees. And if you haven't already, you can do a little fertilizer on the lawn to prep it for next year, but it's not necessary at this point.
What kind of fertilizer are you talking about here? Is this a green?
An organic fertilizer. You can be using your compost pile to spread. You can do compost tea. You can do a mulching around, and that will work.
Okay, work in some compost around the trees and possibly fertilize the lawn. Mm-hmm. Is that it? Now it's time for you to hibernate, to go to sleep for the winter?
It is. We have a couple of bonus tips, like seek out your local garden club, read a good garden book, and pretty soon you're going to be under the onslaught of hundreds of garden catalogs coming your way. While you're looking at those garden catalogs, you can be planning next year's garden.
It's the time to dream.
Exactly.
To dream of future plans. Kathy Jens, great to see you again.
Great to be here.
Again, for more information, you can go to our website. We'll have links to the Washington Gardener magazine page. Just go to metroconnection.org. Kathy Jens is the editor and publisher of Washington Gardener magazine. And finally today, from White House party crashers desperate for television exposure to ghost chasers, dog whisperers, and bridezillas, Few would add reality TV to the list of things we're thankful for this holiday season. But as writer Jessica Piscatelli says, like it or not, it's coming to D.C. in a big way. And she admits she does kind of like it.
Reality has come to D.C. In 2010, we will have the privilege of hosting both The Real World and The Real Housewives of D.C. Finally, we get to see what happens when D.C. stops being political and starts getting real. There are two things I want to understand. Why would anyone want to be the star of a reality TV show? And why do we, the viewers, keep watching? There are some reality shows that show off talent. If you're a dancer, singer, chef, or designer, reality TV can fast-track a career that otherwise might never get off the ground. But if you're a wife or a mother or a kid going to college or starting out in life, where is the benefit in having millions of people watch your every move? Where's the fun in having an ordinary life critiqued under a microscope? On the flip side, why do we watch? There's something exciting when you challenge a top chef to create a gourmet meal out of food found in a vending machine. There are performances to watch on dancing and singing shows and beautiful designs to critique on the design shows. But the shows that are about the real world, about going shopping, hanging out with your girlfriends, or going out clubbing? I have to admit, I do watch. As a writer, I was opposed to reality TV for a long time. I was rooting for shows that have characters and plotted storylines. It was a battle I lost. There are a few shows out there that I just can't look away from, even if I know some of that reality is not so real. Karl Marx stated that religion is the opium of the people. At some point in recent history, that phrase was updated to state that TV is the opiate of the masses. I would like to posit instead that TV has become the religion of the people. Reality TV stars no longer need to pray to an all-seeing God when they tuck themselves in at night. They're being watched over by several million people while they sleep. And we, the viewers who tune in on their lives, we sometimes have the power to vote and decide their fates, but we always have the power to pass judgment. All around me is such
unreality. Writer Jessica Piscatelli keeps waiting for reality TV to come to her town. The Real World, Reston, anyone? And for this week, that's Metro Connection. We had extra production help from Jonathan Shari, Toby Schreiner, Andrew Chadwick, and Bill Redlin. The show's theme song, Zero Wave, was written and performed by the D.C. area band, Astrolite. You can hear Metro Connection on the web if you wanted to hear a news segment again, or if you'd like to download a podcast. Just go to our webpage, metroconnection.org. As always, we'd like to thank our webmaster, Jason Novak. We'd like to hear what you have to say about the show. The Metro Connection listener comment line is 202-885-8854. Again, that's 202-885-8854.